them, meet me I, love them, because we love them.
Them a call us pirates, them a call us illegal broadcasters, just because we play what the Caro wants.
Yeah, please.
So them a call us pirates, them a call us
illegal broadcasters.
PTI try stop us, but they can't.
Do it live.
Hey, welcome to the Interracial John Podcast. I'm your host at Leslie Mack. I'm joined as always
by this very white guy.
And you are very white indeed. What's going on, man?
It's been a week.
It's been a week.
It's a long hiatus.
Hiatus. But here we are. Yeah. Podcast-atus. I don't know if that's official or not. If you're just joining us for the first time, you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Interracial John. That's J-A-W-N. Or you can find us on our website, interracialjohn.com. And of course, we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr. Just search at Interracial John, J-A-W-N.
What she said.
Yeah.
Should we jump right into it?
Yeah, let's do it.
The news is coming on. The news is coming on.
So I started on Ferguson Response Network. I put together kind of a this week kind of thing, kind of recap of stuff that I've seen that I think people should be watching or reading or looking at. So I'll just give a quick rundown of that.
Okay.
Two videos that I included. One is American Policing, Lessons on Resistance. This was from the Schomburg Center. It was live this past Wednesday night. It featured Michael Smith, Brown Blaze, Philip Agnew, Dante Berry, and Sherelle Brown, also known as Awkward Duck. Ashley Yates is the real name of Brown Blaze, but they all participated in a panel about American policing and lessons on resistance. It was a really dynamic and wonderful panel. So I have that. The other is Ta-Nehisi Coates spoke at Washington University in St. Louis this past week also, and so you can watch that entire hour and a half talk and Q&A that he did. He read an excerpt from his forthcoming book. I think it's coming out in the fall, and delved into the death of one of his friends from his childhood that was killed by police because they thought he was someone else. And it's really moving and really great. You know, he's, in my opinion, you know, just one of the best writing minds out there right now. So
I remember I didn't get to see it, and I'm glad it's the recording's up there, and we'll include it in the podcast.
Yeah.
But my timeline, people were live tweeting it.
Oh my God,
very quote worthy.
Really,
hour and a half.
Yeah, really amazing stuff from him. And it's funny because I heard a few people say that they heard he was kind of didn't have a lot of hope in his speech, and I have noticed this, that when, you know, he's a writer, you know, he's not an activist,
right.
He's not a social justice worker or anything like that. He's a writer. And when you write, it's very hard not to have those feelings come through because that's the place he's coming from. And
well,
I think that's interesting.
I wouldn't say just a writer. I think as a, you know, he seems to be, you know, he illuminates and highlights history that's sometimes not very well, you know, I would say known, but right, he's talking about things and showing things. It'd be hard not to be, you know, want for him as a writer to be very accurate and from that maybe pragmatic, and that might come off as cynical to some. But I don't. I remember when we were at UPenn, and he came and spoke,
mm-hmm.
and somebody asked almost not the same thing, but like, you know, how can we make it easier for, you know, how can we soften the blow? And he's just like, it's not my job,
right?
I'm not here to make this comfortable for you.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't like rude about it, but
no,
just like,
no.
That's not what I do. You know, there's
it's
other
not.
People that do that.
And I also think that there, you know, yes, I think that people that work in social justice or do social justice work, because we often are striving towards something or we're working on a goal of something, we are able to come at things from a different perspective. But I think he's a writer, and it's just a different place to come from. It's very personal on some side of things, and he's giving his take on something in an informational format. It's not meant to push an agenda. It's not meant to move you to do something.
No, it's not fiction.
It's very different in that way. So anyways, so that was really good. I have three articles that I highlighted. One, I think you're going to touch on a little bit, which is regarding the video of the police shooting of Brandon
right.
Tate Brown here in Philadelphia. The other is from the New York Times, which talks about challenging white privilege from the inside, a program at several New York private schools where they are really pushing to educate their mostly white students about white privilege. It's really interesting and something I think could work at a lot of schools. And the third is a blog post from Black Girl in Maine. Shout out to her. The Inhumanity, Train Ride, or Where Are All the Good White People, where she recounts an incident that she had on the train going home in Maine. And then a couple of hashtags I shouted out. One was Malcolm 50, which was highlighting things and people and quotes honoring Malcolm X, who we had the 50th anniversary of his assassination this weekend. The other was Blackout Tour, very new, something that started just this weekend for the first time in New York City, where they group, I think it was, yeah, BYP 100, got a bunch of people together and went to the Museum of Quote Unquote Natural History and just went to town in there, pointing out different exhibits and pieces that are pretty much monuments to white supremacy. It's really freaking cool, and I think it's gonna, you're gonna see a lot more of it. They're also hashtag train takeover was another takeover of the train system in Chicago. This one was about the reparations bill that's put forth.
HR40.
No, this is a local reparations bill in Chicago. Sorry, which has to do with torture that people received in Chicago jails, which has been proven, and there's a reparations bill put forth that these people should be given restitution for the atrocities that they experienced at the hands of the police. And then the last one, which I actually will touch on a little bit again later, is hashtag Black History You Didn't Learn in School. Amazing hashtag, just sick information and amazing history lessons going on there. So it's my little rundown for this week.
Very nice.
Yeah.
That's a good series. And those are all at the FRN?
Yep. It's actually, if you just go to FergusonResponse.org, you'll see it's the very first link that's on there. And of course, we'll include it in the show notes as well.
Okay. And you're going to do that every week?
Yeah, we'll do it every week.
I like it. Yeah. Nice. So did you hear about the rate of gentrification here in Philly?
Yeah.
It was kind of news to me. I didn't realize it. Maybe I hadn't seen it. But so there are other cities that are more gentrified as a larger percentage of their lower income neighborhoods.
Right.
But what this article and this study was looking at more specifically was the rate of gentrification from 1990 to 2013.
Right.
Well, that's 2 years ago when they had the data.
Got it.
So in terms of acceleration, Philly was number two at the fastest accelerating rates of gentrification, mm-hmm. in part because it was so in shambles in 1990. Not in shambles, but the ability to gentrify was, Philly was behind the curve in doing that, as other cities had started doing it sooner.
Well, interestingly enough, too, I do remember that during that same time period that Philadelphia was the only, besides Detroit, was the only other top 10 city that had declined in
population
during that time. And I would posit that you see a big correlation there.
Well, and a population is declining, that you're not going to see gentrification, of course.
No, that a population decline is a precursor
to
rapid gentrification.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. There's interesting. There's another piece we'll talk about a little bit later that talks about declining crime in various cities.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the indicators is just that, is incoming new residents, particularly younger individuals, younger professionals moving into an area. So they're talking about gentrification as being an indication of lowering crime. But anyway, Philadelphia, you had 1.5% in 1990, and now they're up to 28% of those neighborhoods have been gentrified.
Wow.
A staggering 1,800% increase.
Wow.
So other areas have, like I said, gentrified more, but Philly's rate of expansion has really been rapid. And we've heard a couple of people from we go to various meetings and groups,
sure.
and there's individuals with Temple, mm-hmm. and talking about the area, North Philadelphia,
yep.
And Temple specifically. And you see that a lot.
They're just eating it up.
Yeah, they just expand and expand and expand, and it's almost like they create a little bit of a bubble,
right?
Because they have their own little police department.
Right.
They've got their own blue lights and, because parents don't want to send kids to a school that they think is not safe. So
sure.
Regardless where it is, even my campus in Kalamazoo, Michigan, which is a, much smaller town, it had its own little filter bubble, right? Like you're on campus versus you're not on campus.
Right. Which, it's funny. I was thinking about this in Evanston. I feel like Evanston was, I wouldn't call it a college town because, it's a pretty big city. But I didn't feel that much of a divide there.
But I never knew how small Northwestern really was.
Yeah.
But I assumed Northwestern was much, much bigger.
Right.
And I don't know why I assumed it was much, much bigger.
Because it's a big campus.
Well, you play on a big stage, though. You've got a Big Ten team. You might be one of the smaller Big Ten universities.
Yeah.
Because you said how many went to school?
I don't know. We were just looking it up. We can look it up again.
Yeah,
later.
It was small.
It's irrelevant. But my point was just I didn't feel the bubble.
Fair enough.
I felt very not just – I felt like my college life was fine away from campus and was
Yeah.
That was expected. There wasn't this expectation of staying close to it, you know, kind of thing.
Well, and it was not an odd place to be, but, you know, Evanston's not a real big urban area. No. You're kind of isolated in general in some ways, but then you're not. I remember I went and visited in Cincinnati, Xavier, and that was in Cincinnati. So it's a pretty big city.
Yeah.
It was like right in the middle of downtown Cincinnati. And it was like these 9 buildings and that was it.
Right.
It was like this very, very small bubble.
Mm-hmm.
But it was still a bubble nonetheless. But same, Philly, dubious distinction. And we've been hearing people locally impacted by it. And it's unfortunate to be on that list.
Yeah, for sure. I wanted to give a quick update. I know we spoke a lot about Argentina a couple weeks ago with all of the issues surrounding Alberto Niesman's death, who's a prosecutor there, and accusations that the president was involved. And
Bring us up to speed, because it was the president who's accusing
the president and her cabinet basically of trying to hide Iran's complicity in the terrorist attack that took place in Argentina about 15 years ago. And he was killed. Presumably, people are saying, you know, pundits and people are saying in Argentina to stop him from continuing.
He was killed. He was ruled a suicide.
Yeah.
And it's depending on, everyone's a pocket forensic, whatever. But it was ruled a suicide the night before he was due to testify and deliver this maybe scathing report indicting the president of the country.
Correct.
Got it.
Some 400,000 people walked in pouring rain from Congress past Mr. Niesman's former office to the presidential palace. They carried signs demanding truth and justice for Mr. Niesman, who was found shot dead in his bathroom, and for the 85 victims of the 1994 bombing of a Jewish center in Buenos Aires. So this was this past February.
400,000. That's 400,000.
It's the hugest march they've seen yet. This one was organized by fellow prosecutors in Niesman's honor.
Wow. And they marched to Casa Rosada.
Yeah. And that's what we saw. Remember, I was telling you I saw photos from friends online. And I was like, this looks like they're at a protest. And it looks like they're definitely in VA.
And the number of people we saw that we knew ideologically were not of the same party in terms of like Democrat, Republican, but we're still marching together.
Yeah. And also it was people that I wouldn't have even said were politically charged and generally speaking.
I mean, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah. And of course, presidential elections coming up
September.
In October there.
Yeah.
And, Cristina Fernandez can't run again. This is her second term, so she's done. But obviously, her party, which is a Peronist party, this is a big deal, and kind of vultures are circling and certainly bring a lot of attention to this. It's just very confusing, and just sending out hope for some stability there, and that they do get the answers they're seeking, because I do think that, it's important to want truth, especially when your country and your government has had a past of covering up things that have been very painful to people. So I really hope that they're able to get the answers they're looking for in that arena, for sure.
Speaking of cover-ups and not getting answers.
Yeah.
I don't take joy in doing Yes All Cops.
Yes All Cops sucks, but
it does. It is what it is. So Saturday here in Philly, went down onto Frankfort Avenue and participated in action. We shut down a street and marched a bit. Had a cavalcade, probably about 100 people, and it was really heavy snow. The weather was terrible, but it was good. It was good to see people out there for Brandon Tate Brown, and the action was specifically for him. He was shot and killed by police on Frankfort Avenue, right where we started, about the 6600 block. It's known as the Mayfair area.
Section.
Yeah, if you're familiar with Philly, the Markford-Frankford line, the MFL line, the blue one, ends right there, right by
McGee and Frankfort.
And the bridge is there, the Tacony.
December 15th, he was killed.
So there's so much wrong, with every one of these killings.
Yeah.
And I'll just say the action part of what I struggle with Brandon is that, you know, there's some folks I think that feel he's not the right victim because he had he was incarcerated. He'd been, you know, he served his time. I'm going to, you know, he there's a reason why his mom's talked about it. But he was turning his life around and he's executed, right? Extrajudicially killed. And the police narrative, what they've said, we now know there's a couple of demands. Was one, who are the officers involved? They haven't even said that, right? So it's been 2 months. We don't even know who the officers
are. They cleared them last week. But we don't even know who they are.
We don't know who they are.
Just to be clear on that.
And Ramsey says he'll never give the names.
And if you get pulled over right now, the person who killed him could be the cop
correct.
That you interact with currently.
And he said that we'll never give those names up because he's afraid of retaliation.
Yeah, Charles Ramsey, this is the man that our president has appointed to head up the policing task force that he's putting together.
Correct.
Just saying.
Correct.
Just to be clear.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the other issue is that there's some video footage. There's businesses that have, you know, security cameras. So they said, you know, release the video. And I find it interesting that, you know, someone's killed an individual, a civilian, and you can get Freedom of Information Act and get all this sort of data, but a police officer kills a civilian and all of a sudden it's under lock and key. We can't show you anything. And they finally relented. And I'll say, you know, finally, I think protest works, you know, absolutely. 2 months, they hadn't released the video and they showed the video in a private screening to Brandon's mother, Miss Tanya, and her lawyers. And I guess an investigator they're working with at the Internal Affairs Bureau. And right away, they weren't shy. The lawyer said in the article that you referenced in your FRN shout out, must, a couple of things that are very troubling that are in stark contrast to what the police have been saying all along.
Not just what they've been saying, just to be clear. Their
lies.
Official statement.
Yeah.
They have done interviews. They have given
correct.
Statements on the radio.
Correct.
And they have the report that actually was filed
correct.
About the crime. Okay,
correct.
So there's four ways in which this information, this false information has been given out to the public officially from the Philadelphia police.
Yeah, it's not
department.
Just like what they're trying to push.
Correct.
It's what they've actually said,
yes.
done.
On the record.
Quoted.
Yes.
On the record. Correct. Their actual police report. Indicates that they pulled Brandon over for having no headlights on, and in the video his headlights are on. The report indicates that he struggled with the officers and then went lunging back into his car and was shot at that point. And there's another officer struggling, and the other officer was kind of like at the side of the car. And that's not at all true. He was seen, observed, running across the street in the back of the car, running across Franklin, running away from being attacked and shot. And there's just – even if you were to – even their statement now indicates there was two people on the scene. There was this gun in the glove box. He went back for it, and he got killed by lunging for this gun. You know, they had him out of the car, and there was a time where there was one officer out of the car and the other officer on the other side of the car. In the video, what did the officer just like not search the vehicle? So at best, he's inept. Right? They did a terrible, terrible job, if you were to believe what happened. Or it's kind of like staged. I don't want to call it a massive cover-up, but it's really troubling. It's like, is it one or two lies, or is it one big, giant lie? And so we marched and shut down Frankfort, a bunch of streets, and I ended up at the 15th precinct, and it was very emotional. Miss Brown was there. Frank McQueen's mother was there. And The Yes All Cops piece, and I don't want to say it was disturbing, but they do it every time here in Philly, and I'm sure they do it in other cities too. And like, I swear to God, the number of black police officers that they put out front of these actions, there's like 14 of them. I know them by face, and that
it's
one
the same
guy,
ones.
Same
every
guy
time.
With the brown coat
yep.
and the armband.
Yep.
It's just every time.
Every
it's
time.
The same number of
that's
of,
the guy
of black
that pointed me
officers.
And said, yep, that's one of them.
Well, so him. We're at the 15th, and you know, there's a railing, like a handicap ADA railing,
right.
and we're on the sidewalk, but we're, you know, we got our loudspeaker, we're shouting, you know, we're chanting, we're, you know, Miss Brown's speaking emotionally, and they've got the phalanx of black officers up front, and on the corner, they got a whole bunch of white officers in like an SUV, I shit you not, like sipping coffee. And so someone was really kind of talking, like getting really deep, just like, you know, I can't believe what you guys must go through. You know, you're black and you're, you know, that's not your family. Yeah, I know how it is. If you say something goes dirty and you don't, and you say something, you snitch, and we're talking about snitching. If you snitch, you're not going to get backup. They stop calling your backup and your ass is out there on your own. And you can't afford to do that. That's your life on the line. We got to figure a better way. You know, take off your uniform. You should be standing over here. You should, you know, you, I can't imagine what it's like working for these fucking, you know, white supremacist, racist ass pigs. Look at them over there in the corner. They're all drinking coffee, and they got all you black guys up here in front. You know, it was really kind of like pretty person was speaking powerfully.
Yeah.
And one of the officers starts like snickering, like starts like smiling and like laughing and making a little, you know, like a joke about it. And I can't remember her name, but a very emotional young woman got on the mic and just, I mean, like, let loose. I wish, you know, I was holding said speaker, so I couldn't really record anything. I prefer not to tweet and whatnot when I'm there. But she was spitting fire at this guy. Just how fucking dare you? Don't even look her in the fucking eye. You're sitting here out in front of this building where one of you murdered her son. We're on the street right here. She's a mother. You have kids. How dare you? Don't even fucking look her in the eye. How dare you? How dare you? Just, I mean, really, it was just unbelievable. And then it comes out that one of them might have been the same individual, and I hope we get his badge and his handle. He fucking Instagrammed and put on the Instagram, like, I'm cold and bored, got to lock some people up. Literally. And again, people just, and I don't know who was out in the crowd that was following the gram and had that shit. I don't Instagram at all, but, you know, I was real pleased. It's like, and right away, that here comes, you know, tubby, like, poor, I don't mean tubby, like, offensive, but like a really, like, overweight, like, white, like, superior officer dude comes out, taps him on the shoulders, like, come on, let's, you know, let's go inside. We'll get another, you know, bring another black person out here for his spot.
Let's switch out these black people.
You know, let's go.
One for another.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, two videos that I saw. One, obviously, was Tanya talking, was very moving, but another one was right at the end of the action when you guys said we're marching back towards where Brandon was actually killed. And I don't know, I could just see everybody walking and a guy turned around to the cops and he just said, I hope you know that you're on the wrong side of history here. You're on the wrong side. Mm. And it struck me, just him, you know, looking back at them and having that last thought to say, you know, dude, this is where you want to, that's the side you want to stand on. Really? Really? So,
there's a lot of, you know, needs and solutions and what this and that. I don't know what the solution is with regards to policing, in that, you know, that is their livelihood. They do have a family to feed. They probably, you know, I've been at jobs where I've felt kind of trapped and stuck and, you know, I can't get out. I'm making straight commission. I got it. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. there's struggle where you're like, listen, I'm trying to keep food on the table and the house heated. I understand that. And in particular with law enforcement, you know, if you do say something, you're fucking hung out to dry. You're a pariah.
I mean, hear all of that, but at the same point.
But what's, you know, the solution?
The solution is that nobody should have to go to work and leave their morality at the door before they walk in. And nobody should be going to work and having to pick up the mantle of white supremacy. And
we certainly shouldn't be paying people to do that.
That should not be what's going on.
We as citizens shouldn't be paying for that.
You ask what the options are. That's what the option is for that not to be the case any longer. And, you know, Philip Agnew in the video that I mentioned earlier, he made a comment that, you know, no system will ever tell the truth about itself. Because the moment it does that, it has made itself obsolete.
Yeah, it's
so, you know, it has to be pressure that comes from outside of these systems, because they will never tell the truth about themselves. President Obama is never going to come out and say, hey, all of these police systems are completely racist and they're based on white supremacy and pushing the white agenda and from a white centering police. He's never going to say those things. Yeah. So, you know, that's what we really are fighting for.
And that's why there's
to push back on those systems.
I would say that exact belief right there is why there's two sides to Eric Snowden and what you think about him releasing, you know, private NSA data and basically blowing the whistle on, you know, a massive spying scandal. Some people take that as a heroic move and other people take it as a disastrous, treasonous move.
Yeah.
And I think the only reason there's a division is because of what you just said. You know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I want to actually jump a little bit. I know we had an order, but I think this works a little bit better. Was talk about an article that came out of the New York Times this week about George Washington, our first president here in the United States. It's entitled George Washington Slave Catcher. It's a very short piece. It's not a lot of you know, text or anything. It's very quick to read, and we'll include the link. But it really delves deep into, you know, our view of George Washington and what that means. And, you know, I talk about this all the time about how, you know, our founding fathers were pedophiles and rapists and, you know, enslavers. And, you know, it's great to see all of the good things that came out of the building of this country. Fine. Yeah, yeah. But let's not talk about the past as though it doesn't have this sheen of of a horrificness, acts that were committed by these people that we revere and celebrate on a regular basis. So the article kind of talks very specifically about George Washington's owning of slaves. So I'll just take you through a few pieces that he talks about. Washington was 11 years old when he inherited 10 slaves from his father's estate. He continued to acquire slaves, some through the death of family members, others through direct purchase. And his cachet of enslaved people peaked when he married Martha in 1759, who brought more than 80 slaves to their estate in Mount Vernon. And so on the eve of the American Revolution, nearly 150 souls were counted as part of the property there.
Wow.
Okay. In 1789, he became the first president of the United States, and he was a planter president who used and sanctioned black slavery, and he needed slave labor to maintain his wealth and his lifestyle, his reputation, all of these things. As he aged, he's, you know, flirted a little bit with, you know, trying to quit of the Negroes, he wrote in 1778, but he never actually did.
Is that a verbatim quote?
That's a quote, to quit of the Negroes. But he never actually did. During his two terms in office, he relocated to New York City, which was our original capital, then here to Philadelphia, which was our second capital here, and which is where he served his terms out. And although slavery steadily declined in the North, they decided that they couldn't do without him, couldn't do it here in Philadelphia. And so
that'd be work.
They settled here in Philadelphia, just a few steps away from Independence Hall. Actually, you can go to the first residence now if you'd like to take a tour of it here in Philadelphia. But a roadblock happened. 1780, Pennsylvania, which was a big Quaker state, very active in the abolitionist movement. And they passed in 1780 the Gradual Abolition Act. And the act basically started dismantling slavery. After their 28th birthday, anybody that was enslaved automatically became free. And any slave who entered Pennsylvania with an owner and stayed in the state for 6 months would also automatically be set free. So they put these guidelines in to kind of like not just cut everything off at once, but to have some gradual points at which, okay, you can't do this any longer.
Right.
So our first president, would have it, would have found a little loophole that he employed.
Oh, really?
So just shy of this 6 month period, he would move the slaves that were in his purview here in Pennsylvania and take them back to Mount Vernon in New York. And then he would bring them back.
The old across the border trick.
Yeah.
We know how that goes.
So he would reset the 6 month clock so he continued to keep his slaves. He writes to his personal secretary, Tobias Lear, in 1791, "I request that these sentiments and this advice be known to none but yourself and Mrs. Washington." So he knew how bad this looked. He went on to support policies that would protect slave owners who had invested money in black lives. In 1793, he signed himself the first fugitive slave law, which allowed fugitives to be seized in any state, tried and returned to their owners, and that anyone who harbored or assisted a fugitive faced a $500 penalty and possible imprisonment. And let's just remember, this is 1793, $500. There are people in prison today that cannot afford $500 to get out. So just think about that as in terms of what a penalty that is, and what that would do to somebody who might be sympathetic to a runaway slave in that moment. He made it through almost through his two terms without any major involvement, incidences regarding his slave owning. Although on the spring of May 1796, Ona Judge, a 22-year-old slave, slipped away from the president's house in Pennsylvania. She had come into their home at age 15. She was among a small cohort of 9 slaves who actually lived with the president and his family in Philadelphia. And she was Martha Washington's first attendant. She took care of all of Martha's personal needs. She ran because Martha had decided she was going to give her away as a wedding gift to her granddaughter. Let me repeat that again.
You're my personal assistant, and as a fucking thank you. I'm going to give you away to my – you're my best slave.
Yep.
You're my favorite. I love you.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you away
I'm
to somebody
give you
else.
Away to my granddaughter.
You're amazing.
So Judge fled Philadelphia. She went all the way up to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where there was a city which had 363 black people and virtually no slaves at all. She married someone. They had three children. She married a free black sailor. But of course, she was very vulnerable because if she was found because of the act that I mentioned earlier,
sure.
Her and her children would be returned. They belonged to Martha Washington. So let me just tell you this: that for 3 years, George Washington pursued his agents, pursued Judge. He dispatched friends, officials, relatives to find and recapture her. 12 weeks before his death, he was still actively pursuing this 25-year-old woman. She had close allies that managed to have her elude the slave catching grasp. When he died in 1799, he had 318 enslaved people at Mount Vernon. Fewer half of them belonged to him personally, and he called for the emancipation of his slaves following the death of his wife. And so when they had no biological children to bequeath the slaves to. So his actual slaves, when Martha died in 1802, were freed as he requested in his will, although hers, the other half of that 318, were given to people that inherited the rest of the estate and such. So
318 is a number you don't hear very often.
Sure.
At his death, 318.
Yeah.
And then he was moving them, doing the cross the county line, cross the state line, rope-a-dope,
yep,
to extend the 6 month indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would say, like, survey says 100 people, George Washington, and you're going to hear like dollar bill and chopped cherry tree. Yeah, never tell a lie. Yeah.
All of those.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not going to hear 318 people.
Fucking,
And doggedly pursuing a 25-year-old who just didn't want to be sold.
I'll have to find I shared it on Twitter, but I'll find it for the podcast. And it was like historians against racism or something like that. But they were basically talking about the sometimes dangerous but not often talked about way in which anti-racism work can still look like colonial and imperial and have systems of hierarchy and have problematic behaviors, even within, you know, like basically like not quite the ally industrial complex, but kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And so they made these larger kind of meta descriptions and interpretations of how and why that is come to be. And part of it's through history, is through a selective version of history.
Sure.
And that's a really big part of it. And they were talking about the anti-slavery people that we hold up even now, or anti-abolitionist people that we hold up, you know, even today, might have had back then, you know, talking about in the 1860s, 1900s, still a really very problematic colonial, imperial, you know, they were still driven by a lot of really terrible things.
Sure, absolutely. I say that all the time. You talk about the Civil War, you know, and people will argue, oh, you know, the Civil War. People in the South will argue, there's this argument, it's like, it wasn't about slavery, it was about states' rights, which is bullshit because they really were fighting for that. But I will also say that it wasn't about slavery for the North. They did not go to war because they wanted the slaves to not be slaves. They went to war because they said, you can't leave. They went to war because, like, yeah, you're not taking half the country, especially part of it that has a significant amount of wealth associated with it. Not going to happen. So, you know, the South seceded and then the North went to war. I like to make sure we have those distinctions in place, because it wasn't a case of, you know, people took up arms for the Union Army because they wanted to free the slaves. It's not true. It just isn't true.
Right.
So I will just one quick quote at the end of this little story, which a reporter asked Judge if she had any regrets about leaving the Washingtons. Quote, "No, I am free and have, I trust, been made a child of God by the means." She died on February 25th, 1848, and she earned a salute during the month of February.
Ah, she lived quite a while.
Yeah, she sure did.
50 years as a free woman outside of.
Yeah, she sure did.
Martha's fucking boudoir.
Yes.
As her personal.
So shout out to Erica Armstrong Dunbar, who authored the op-ed piece, George Washington Slave Catcher.
Nice.
She's an associate professor of black studies and history at the University of Delaware. And she also is the author of A Fragile Freedom, African-American Women and Emancipation in the Antebellum City. So shout out to you.
Right on.
What's up, Erica?
So you hear that crime in general, violent crime, is plummeting despite what some people like you to want to believe, I guess.
Yeah,
the news would make you believe because the news over represents it.
Sure, that's all you see.
Yeah, but so in general, U.S. is becoming safer. Crime has fallen by about 50%,
which has been the case for about 30 years now.
It went through it. So that last piece we were talking about gentrification, we talked about the acceleration of gentrification,
right.
And in the same sense, this article is talking about not just crime in general, but the drop in crime in some cities relative to others.
Right.
And so
what the differences might be.
Yeah. And they, again, the conclusion they come to is really drawing individuals in. A city that's growing, in particular, it's only going to be really growing, or that conclusion that more often grows at the rate that would support this by young professionals, young individuals. They said anywhere you have young men congregating, crime tends to go down, actually.
All young men?
They didn't make a distinction in the article.
I'm not saying there is, or I just was curious to know what that means. Young employed men, young white collar men, any young men?
I'll find the exact quote.
Okay.
I'm going to have to pause it so I find the quote.
I see here. The biggest predictor of crime is having lots of young men in dense proximation. Many of the places where plummeting crime rates happen to be college towns, where they attract high concentrations of young people.
That's probably primarily white institutions.
Certainly, not just white institutions, but definitely professional. They're not talking about blue collar congregations of men. They're not talking about coal miners.
But he say not only
factory workers.
Although that's a predictor in terms of a correlate. They did conclude that police departments need to be working with community and not just policing it, implementing policies that work towards less segregated, more integrated community with the opportunities for more people.
Really? Oh my gosh! Wait a second. You mean to tell me when you take away poverty and you give people opportunity, crime goes down?
And that was the other statistic.
It's fucking, I can't believe it.
The other correlate was that of the 10 cities that have had the fastest or the from 91 to 2013 had the greatest deceleration of crime, 7 out of the 10 of those were significantly lower unemployment than the national average.
No.
Like 4-3% unemployment versus the 7-8% nationally.
That goes back to that rat thing we were talking about with regard to addiction.
Yeah, kind of
does. I say that all the time, and actually in the other video I mentioned, the American Policing video, they really talk a little bit about that. They touch on this idea of if we attack the root causes of crime instead of just treating the symptoms of it, if we attack poverty, if we increase education, if we increase, if we decrease unemployment, all of those things end in the same result as lowering crime. So if you as an entity, as a state, as a government want to lower crime, that's what you should be looking at. Those are the things that actually work with nobody can argue with the statistics. Nobody can argue with the numbers. Nobody can argue with the facts. When you have those three things affected, crime goes down.
Yeah.
Yet we see time and time again, that's not what is looked at. It's about invading neighborhoods. It's about criminalizing people of a certain color and income level. It's about, again, treating the symptoms instead of going after the root cause of these problems. It's just like continually ramming your head against a wall for no reason. It doesn't make any sense. That's the thing that always – that the thing that frustrates me most about social justice work and being an activist is – when you can see plainly what the solutions to these problems are. Maybe you don't know exactly how to get there, but you certainly can see why what's going on now is not working and nobody gives a shit. And that's why the movement, when we say Black Lives Matter, because the complete and utter denial of these facts is what tells us that Black lives don't matter. Because if they did, because the only people that are getting killed and the only people are dying, the only people that are bearing the brunt of this complete denial of reality is Black people. So obviously we don't matter. It's clear. If white people were having these same problems, let me tell you something. People would be like, hold on a second. We got to reassess. We got to figure out why this is going on and make sure it's not continuing to happen because we can't have all these white people dying all over the place.
Oh, but again, that's of course, because it's deliberate. You know, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm totally agreeing with you, but it would never be that way because whiteness has designed the system to be able to perpetuate anti-blackness
it's
in this
true,
way.
It's true. And a system is just that. It's something that runs without anybody
in
input. It continually runs. So,
And that's why I had something the other day. It was like, the more I do some of this stuff, the more I feel like just a a lunatic barking at the moon, just standing on the corner like, you know, I'm the crazy one. But
yeah, and you know, it's funny. I've been having this thought process in my head too about, you know, not, you know, the thing I think that I hope people are getting out of the Black Lives Movement is that this is not eye on the prize type of movement. This is not a checklist movement. This is not a movement with which we think that there's an end game in sight. This is about a complete change of our society. And it's about building people that are going to continually do that work because it never ends. So for me, I'm not disheartened by the fact that we might be feeling like we're being at the moon or whatever, because that's great, and that may be true today, but the idea is to continually build a society and a community that is aware of these things and can continue to work on them. And that's where I see, you know, we're at the early stages of this thing. It's not going to happen. It's been 400 years of oppression and subjugation and white supremacy that have taken a hold of our very being, you know? This idea that our history starts with us being slaves, this idea that Lincoln emancipated us, this idea that, you know, so many things came from the Renaissance. It's just fucking ridiculous. It's crazy talk. And, you know, the more that we talk about these things, the more that we're able to connect with other people that are willing to look at them, the better off we are as a society. So I see it very differently.
I'll give that a bell. Ding.
Ding.
So in case anyone's wondering, there are places where crime's actually soaring. And one of the top of the list was Bismarck, North Dakota.
What the fuck is going on in North Dakota?
The oil boom. So they've
isn't that people like beat up people with
a lot of aggravated assaults. So they've got very low unemployment and a very high income, and I guess a very high beer consumption.
That doesn't surprise me. There's not much to do.
The local police capabilities have been stretched. But some of the cities that were crime was going down were like Racine, Wisconsin, and Dubuque, Iowa.
There weren't a lot of college towns.
Yeah, they weren't exactly
big deal.
Big cities, yeah.
Well, one other thing that I did want to talk about was Justine Sacco.
Justine Sacco?
Yeah, Justine Sacco may be better known as the South Africa tweet. South Africa AIDS tweet woman.
Oh, right.
If you recall.
Did she work at Gawker or she?
Last year. Well, I'll just, yeah, she, last year she was going to South Africa. She was a senior director of corporate communications at IAC is where she worked.
Okay.
And she was tweeting, as people are wont to do.
IAC is the internet advertising?
Yes.
That's like I want to say she's a high-ranking official. CEO, what was she?
She was a senior director of corporate communications.
Oh, Jesus.
She's a PR.
She was a senior director level of corporate communications for an internet advertising coalition, a large one, like a PAC within the industry, right?
Yeah.
And her job is corporate communications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just want to make sure. It's not like a little oopsie. Like, this is her job. She does this for a living.
Right. Now, she was tweeting from her personal account, so just say that, but I do want to just, I always like to give that context because
for
me, it did personally give myself, you know.
It's a qualification.
It's a qualification. Okay.
I gotcha.
So she tweets a bunch of stuff. She tweets from JFK, "Weird German dude, you're in first class. It's 2014. Get some deodorant." Inner monologue as I inhale BO. Thank God for pharmaceuticals. Then at her layover in Heathrow, she says, chili, cucumber sandwiches, bad teeth, back in London. And then on December 20th, before the final leg of her trip to Cape Town, quote, going to Africa. Hope I don't get AIDS. Just kidding. I'm white. End quote. She chuckled to herself and pressed send, and then she got on her phone.
She's taking those pharmaceuticals for the first leg.
She checked her phone for about a half an hour. She only had about 170 Twitter followers at this time when she sent this tweet. So just to give you some context to that as well, it was an 11-hour flight. She slept. She landed. And right away, her phone gets a text. I'm so sorry to see what's happening. She's like, what are you talking about? Then somebody else, you need to call me immediately, from her best friend, Hannah. And then her phone exploded. It was Hannah. You're the number one trending worldwide on Twitter right now. And her feed had become a horror show.
Oh, no.
In light of @Justine-Sacco's disgusting racist tweet, I'm donating to At Care Today. And how did @Justine Sacco get a PR job? Her level of racist ignorance belongs on Fox TV. #AIDS can affect anyone. And then I'm an IEC employee, and I don't want at Justine Sacco doing any communications on our behalf ever again.
What?
Ever. And then from one from her employer, IAC, they own the Daily Beast, OkCupid, and Vimeo, quote, "This is an outrageous, offensive comment. Employee in question currently unreachable on an international flight," end quote.
Wow. In 11 hours, it went from fucking 150 followers tweet to bloop.
Then, this part's funny. I'm just going to read it because I think it's hilarious. The anger soon turned to excitement. Quote, "All I want for Christmas is to see at Justine Sacco's face when her plane lands and checks her inbox / voicemail." And, quote, "Oh, man, at Justine Sacco is going to have the most painful phone turning on moment ever when her plane lands." And finally, quote, "We are about to watch this Justine Sacco bitch get fired in real time before she even knows she's getting fired," end quote. As she landed, literally there were reporters waiting for her outside of the airport.
Of course.
She had, of course, thousands of stuff going on. People took photos of her when she got there, and all sorts of stuff. And she got fired. Duh.
Yeah.
So there was a gentleman, specific journalist, A.A. Gill, who tweeted it out. And
he did more than that. He put in an article.
Yeah, he put in an article.
And it wasn't just an article. It was an article in BuzzFeed or Gawker. What was
it? Yeah, I think it was Gawker.
So he's a journalist, and his article, I'm not saying he was the catalyst, but, you know, there's certain contributing factors, and certainly his amplification of her tweet was significant.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that he caused, right? Like, I'm not saying
after this. Well, he amplified
it. I didn't say after this because of this, but certainly there's a lot of factors, and it was her action. Let's start with that. It was her action, but the amplification via Gawker certainly is a contributing factor. And he knows that.
Sure. So Justine says that she has felt really bad. You know, they fired her, of course, and then she would watch other people's lives kind of go up in flames because of a tweet. You know, remember that girl on Halloween who dressed up as a Boston Marathon victim? Do you remember that?
Oh, my Lord, yes.
I mean, how stupid can you get? And the author attempts to go and meet with Justine and just wanted to talk with her about the effect of this and what happens. And
well, I thought, if I remember, maybe I read the different article, I thought Justine reached out to the author all sort of like spuriously, like, "Hi, it's Justine Sacco." And he's like, whoa. He like kind of like not freaked out, but it was like, what should I do? I, you know, didn't know. Like he kind of consternated, and they finally agreed to meet.
No, you mean the gentleman that had given the tweet out, which is Sam Biddle. But no, the person that I'm talking about wrote this New York Times article about about Justine. It's a pretty long article. I don't need to go through the whole thing. She goes very deep into you know, what happened afterwards and so on and so forth, and you know that she didn't feel it was fair, and she cried, you know, for days, and her family was embarrassed and all this other stuff and blah 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 blah, and all sorts of other stuff she goes into. And you know, Sam Biddle, who's the one who did the Gawker post, you know, felt like he was really the one that pushed it so hard and all of this other stuff and da 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 da. And she wanted to tell her own story. I think that was part of her initial, you know, reason for doing it. And Biddle eventually wrote an apology of sorts to her publicly, bring back bullying, because he had a thing that called Bring Back Bullying, a tweet that had gotten him some bad press as well.
Okay.
And so he just kind of was like, it turns out, you know, she's not a racist monster. She's a woman, and she threw back a few cocktails, and she, you know, was a normal person, and he probably shouldn't have jumped to all of this stuff because she was going to, you know, visit family and da 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 da, apologizing to her, pretty much.
Got it.
Okay. So that's the narrative that it's out there, you know, all this stuff. And I think this is certainly a, you know, a modern problem to have, you know, your online persona and what that means and how people will take it and so on and so forth. What do you think about it? Like, what do you think about you know, the fact that this attention, the title of the New York Times article is "How One Stupid Tweet Blew Up Justine Sacco's Life."
So, and I think it's interesting that we're giving so much attention, even the New York Times now after the fact, to one individual. Mm-hmm. When it's, you know, we just already said on the show that it's, you know, systemic stuff that's really the problem.
Right.
And I'm guilty of this too. It's just so much easier to see and confront an individual, especially online when it's Twitter.
Sure.
It's like there's a pseudo anonymity that's there. There's a wall of like whatever, and you can just be like, oh, F this person. Look at him, they're horrible racist. And, you know, and I do – there aren't many other mediums, right? I would say in general for Twitter, just like specifically, there's not a lot of other places where like, you know, really like one tweet can really do a lot of damage. There's not a lot of other places and spaces you can operate in where you can do one thing that's just like, you know, implosion on a massive scale. And I'm not saying, you know, ends justifies the means or what her intent was. You know, was her tweet offensive? Yeah. Was it the worst thing I've ever heard? Not at all. Was it the most offensive thing I've heard? Not even close. Was it, you know, the most offensive thing done by somebody on Twitter that day? Probably not, you know. Was it the most offensive thing? Even better, was she at IAC inherently the most racist person? No fucking way, right? No way. I guarantee you there's somebody at IAC that's like, you know, I'm not trying to like slander them, but they're a big enough company. They got fucking white supremacists and really horrible bigoted people. Guarantee it. And I don't know her enough to say that she is or isn't, but I don't think that that one tweet is like the worst thing in the world. But I do understand she's in charge of communications. That's, you know, it was a terrible mistake and there are consequences. And okay, she paid a lot for those consequences. And let's get on with it. Like, why do we need to really have like the apology to her for an individual, right? It's just like, I don't know. On some level, I get, and I'm guilty of it too. And I even, you and I talked about it with the, his name was Tyler. He was a Navy, a Marine? What was he? He was a serviceman of some
Marine,
sort.
I think.
And after the Super Bowl had tweeted, or maybe it was Facebook, I think it was tweeted in uniform from his own personal account, again, personal account, something about, you know, oh, all you Seattle, you know, N-words, go home, you know, you're losers now or something. Like literally used the N-word in a tweet. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of people are like, here's his Facebook, here's his command. Here's,
oh, yeah, they doxed him immediately.
Immediately. And I put together a tweet and tagged the U.S. Marine Corps and tagged his handle and screen capped it. And it got retweeted like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times. And I'm not like this Gil guy. I didn't amplify it like that. But at some level, I felt a little bit in the same way, like, what was the purpose? What really did I accomplish other than, you know, and people did the same thing. Like, he just said this one thing. It shouldn't ruin his entire career. You know, and it was both sides. I'm a former Marine. This makes me fucking sick. You know, his Marine mates are going to give him what do they call it? A blanket treatment where they beat the crap out of him. His, you know, CO is going to, you know, fucking brig him. Other people are saying he shouldn't, you know, this is going to ruin him. You know, that's not fair. So I don't say I felt like guilty, like I did anything, but I question my own motives, like what did that serve? What purpose was that for me to do that? And is that making a difference in the world? I don't know. I
don't know. I think it's definitely, you know, and I would have liked the article to be more focused on that. Like, I would have liked the article to talk about the, you know, the sociology and the psychology behind, you know, how the internet wave happens. Mm. There's another story that told in the midst of this. This was in early 2013. He was at a tech conference in Santa Clara, California, and he told a stupid joke about, you know, the dongles that you use for, you know, computing mobile devices stuff, those little dongles. It was so bad, he says, he doesn't remember the exact word, something about a fictitious piece of hardware that had a really big dongle, a ridiculous dongle. Okay, so moments later,
he's making like a dick dongle joke?
Yeah. Moments later,
I have to give him like the A for effort, though.
Yeah, moments later, he half noticed a woman one row in front of them stood up, turned around, and took a photograph. He thought she was taking a crowd shot, so he looked straight ahead to avoid ruining her picture. It's a little painful to look at the photograph now, knowing what was coming. The woman had, in fact, overheard the joke. She considered it to be emblematic of the gender imbalance that plagues the tech industry and the toxic male-dominated corporate culture that arises from it. She tweeted the picture to her 9,209 followers with the caption, "Not cool. Jokes about, quote, big dongles right behind me." 10 minutes later, he and his friends were taken into a quiet room at the conference and asked to explain themselves. 2 days later, his boss called him into his office and he was fired.
Wow.
It doesn't stop there. The woman who took the photograph, Adria Richards, soon felt the wrath of the crowd herself. The man responsible for the dongle joke had posted about losing his job on Hacker News, an online forum popular with developers. This led to a backlash from the other end of the political spectrum. Of course, the so-called men's rights activists and anonymous trolls bombarded Richard with death threats. They doxed her home address with a photograph of a beheaded woman with duct tape over her mouth. She left her house fearing for her life, slept on friends' couches. Then her employer's website went down. Someone launched a DDoS attack, overwhelming the site servers with repeated requests, and they ended up having to fire her publicly so that this would stop. So, you know, I think that's a much more useful view of what can happen in those moments, but on both ends of the spectrum.
It is, but look at that. I don't want to even say the two words, you know, with that GG, yes. Right? I don't even like talking about it. But in the same sense, like what was worse, the thing that happened or your reaction to the thing that you thought happened? Like, the reaction was like she had a right to feel offended and
she
to
did.
Treat that to her people.
Absolutely.
And that guy made a
and
mistake.
Truth be told, and truth be told, that joke is emblematic of the male-dominated culture
Absolutely.
In tech.
Absolutely.
And he cannot deny that. He can say it was well-intended, yes, but if the culture wasn't fostering of an environment where you thought it was okay to tell that joke, then she wouldn't have been offended in that moment.
Absolutely.
And that's a fact.
And for her tweeting that, just tweeting that, she got doxxed, run out of her home, her job, threatened, you know. And there's an element, you're talking about the psychology of it, there's definitely within that wave, there's a, you know, like, I don't know what you call it, like piling on component.
Yeah.
Like there's a phase where it's just like, oh, enough people have retweeted this and they're, you know, vociferous about this. Now I can be vociferous. And you see even like almost like groupthink, where like the thing that people take offense to, they all start hammering on the same sort of talking points, and you know what I mean?
Sure, absolutely. It definitely, like I said, I'd like to see somebody do a story that's a little more in depth about, you know, this wave of how these things come to, you know, to trend and the different parts of it. Because I feel like you could almost name it, you know, there is always going to be a backlash. Where's that backlash coming from? What are they going to say? You know, I'd like to see, you know, the anatomy of these things as they become more and more fervent. And
common,
actually,
sure.
I did a blog post this past week about exposure trolling, which touches on this a little bit because it talks about what I believe to be the intentional trolling of Black Twitter for the benefit of monetary gain, clicks, exposure that has become, I would say, a trend of late. You know, somebody has, you want people to know who you are, just piss off a bunch of Black people and we'll make sure that everybody knows exactly who you are shortly thereafter. I break down a little bit more the outcome of that and some alternatives to what we can do to not let it be as effective, but you know, as Rajik would say, till niggas start waking up and seeing what's going on, it's not going to stop happening. So I'll put a link to that on the show notes as well, but yeah, it's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't know how much I would, if given the opportunity to be engaged in a individual racist and you know, I'm not saying I dox the individual, but like, you know, amplifying like, oh, look at this person did. It's sort of the same in terms of the exposure trolling. The reason exposure trolling works is because individuals are pissed and they say, look at how horrible this company is. And I'm pissed at how this company acted and look what this company did. But all the time it's this company, this company, this company, this company. And in the same sense, like, you know, to what extent was there really value in saying, look at this, you know, racist did this racist, this racist, this racist. You know what I mean? Like, is that really, is there a lot of value in that?
I think, you know, it just depends. I think that there are some unique things about Justine because she was PR for a large company, you know, and she's a senior director. I think that was a delicious kind of salacious piece of the puzzle that I think made this jump farther.
And it's given
what,
virability,
and truthfully, it's
absolutely.
What made Sam even notice it at all.
Of course, was
that fact. So,
if
you've
just been some schmo at some company,
yeah,
who gives a crap?
Yeah, nobody cares.
Correct.
But because of that fact, you know, and I do think that there is a level of culpability you have. You're in PR. You know how things can look. And you just put that out to the public. Yeah, you only had 170 followers, but anybody can see it. So I just, for me, I don't have a lot of, you know, empathy or sympathy.
Yeah.
I just don't have any. You're not a naive 14-year-old girl. You know, you're a professional woman who does PR for a living. And so you know how things can be taken.
Sure.
So,
I said right away that it's a grievous error and there should be consequences. And I don't know if there are, if there's any possibility for the consequence being anything short of being fired. I just don't see how that, right? Like I said, there needs to be consequences, and I stand by that. There absolutely is. And I don't see how anywhere on any planet for this individual in this circumstance, it could have been anything short of their firing. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I'm with you 100%. You know, and I don't think she's been like destroyed. She's working for a small startup now. She's got, you know, there are people, she's employable. She didn't go to jail.
No, I mean, she has a job now. She doesn't want to be in the spotlight. And she actually has said, you know, anything that draws attention to me is not good for me. So she doesn't do that, but she, you know, she's still in PR. And she actually ended up, because the, you know, she just, it was so bad after this happened. She just took a PR job at an NGO in Ethiopia, and she went there for 6 months and just lived in Ethiopia for 6 months, which I can only tell so you privileged. Is the most privileged shit I've ever heard.
Oh my God, the internet's
life.
Making fun of me. I'm going to move to Africa.
I'm leaving the country.
Work.
You. Leaving the country. I'm going to leave the country.
Fuck you guys up. Going to Africa.
Anyway.
Nice.
Anyway.
You want to talk about some TV?
Yes.
It's been a week. We had a lot of TV on.
Lots of good stuff on. Things are back.
Your favorite show, The Flash.
The Flash, for real. I think it's like the best new show this year.
The
CGI is amazing. Awesome. The story's intricate. I love the way they're introducing so many different characters. And I just, you know, DC, what the fuck is, how can they get it so right on TV and so
wrong.
Fucking wrong in the movies? I don't understand. It makes no sense to me.
It is weird.
It's like they have a wall in between the two creative processes and they don't talk to each other because the Flash is going to be in this new bullshit slate of movies they announced, but it's not going to be played by the person that's playing it on TV. So, which fine, you want to keep it separate, but it's doing so well. It's so well received. It's so well done. It's so interesting.
Yeah, but I think like part of that though, and I'm not saying like they're, again, one causes the other. But I said their graphics are so good, their CGI is so good, their writing's so good. But it's on CW.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's a little bit of like, I don't know, like it makes it easier. Like you don't have to really, you're not trying to get 13 million viewers.
You're right. You're not trying to get.
I mean, you're not trying to get 13 million viewers and you're given a budget and you're just like, hey, you know what? We're going to sign. Because I think they even do that. Like they give them a full season. Like CW doesn't really monkey around when they do some of this stuff. And then once they get the response that they need, like they've got the market and the financials figured out. So it's like, okay, we can afford to spend so much producing this show because it's going to get us this much in audience and it's worth that much in revenue.
Right.
And so they've got, you know, it's a margin and it's thinner than NBC's margin, but they put out a pretty good damn product. And I think part of it's because that expectation is not like crazy high. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I hear that. But at the same time, you know, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is doing very well on ABC. And they expect big ratings from that show. And of course, it's Marvel. So they're, you know, I guess they have a little bit stronger of a foothold in that arena. But I do, you know, it was still a step out for them. They've done very well in movies and took this foray into TV.
You know what I was thinking? The Flash does really well, and you know, I haven't talked about this in a while, but there's the element of a TV show that is the long arc, like sort of the, you know, real like 13 episode sort of stuff. And then there's the material that's like in that one episode, like the villain of the week kind of deal.
Right.
And the Flash takes their villain of the week sort of short arc stuff, and it has looped in elements of the long arc very effectively.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you're getting these little pieces like...
Well, you know, it helps. You know, they're searching for these metahumans and they're caused by this catalyst that started the series off. And so every time that they encounter one, the reason they even encounter that person is because of this thing that happened that's part of the larger mythology. So it's built in and it's done very, very well. I don't watch Arrow, but I hear that that's also done really, really well. It's the same DC universe and they have had some crossover episodes already since this first season. And I hear that it's very similar in that way. So, you know, we'll see. But I think that this DC issue it goes back further. I mean, Smallville is a DC property and that was an amazing television show and they did shitty with the movies. So doing the Superman movies. So I feel like it's not a new thing for them having this problem. It's continual and it's been going on for a while now. So, Smallville was on the CW or the WB, whatever it used to be.
Yeah, I used to love that. So I thought Smallville for like 6 of its 8 seasons
was
really good.
Great show and very well done. And all of the things you just, for all the reasons you just said about The Flash.
Yeah.
They take these, you know, these weekly stories and give you more of the larger arc to keep you interested. So you don't feel like you're just watching a procedural. Because if you do that with a superhero show, it just comes off as fake and phony and not interesting at all.
Yeah.
So highly recommend The Flash and shout out to everybody.
So I know you didn't like it as much as I did, but I loved the Parks and Rec's Johnny Karate Super Musical Explosion show.
It was okay. I mean, the show itself was okay. I thought the commercials were hilarious. Well, hey,
I have a couple queued up for you then.
Oh, yeah, that's funny.
Homopoke people have a saying. Only one who listens hears the cry of the wolf. That advice has been passed down from generation to generation. Today, I give that advice to you. Listen for Coinsy the Wolf at Wamapoke Casino. Twice a day, one lucky visitor will hit the Mega Wolf jackpot, and Coinsy will
howl
for you. Wamapoke Casino, slowly taking back our money from white people, one quarter at a time.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
That's hilarious.
I liked his other one, Punch Burger.
Oh, Punch Burger was funny.
We know what you want. Healthy, natural food that still tastes great. And we're here to tell you, it doesn't exist. Healthy food is for suckers. It tastes like garbage, and if you say you like it, you're a chump and a liar. Be honest, this is what you want to eat. The Ponch Burger Dinner for Breakfast Burger Combo. It tastes amazing. What's in it? Who cares? How many calories? Shut up. It's awesome. Put it in your body, or you're a nerd.
It's literally
how many calories? Who cares?
It's a triple stack burger with bacon and cheese and eggs.
Fucking hilarious!
3 fucking patties.
So funny.
Or you're a nerd.
You're a nerd.
So I like the show, and I like the commercial too.
You know, it occurs to me now that especially just listening to the audio of the commercials that Parks and Rec is kind of like a live action King of the Hill.
Yeah, kind of is.
Like, they have all of these completely
ridiculous
characters doing crazy things, and they have all of these idiosyncrasies that they just continually play up, like Gary's name and falling all over the place, and Donna, and whatchamacallit, Aziz's character, Tom.
You're right about that.
It really is so the same.
He fell in the river looking for a burrito.
Yes,
all of that. Yeah, you're
it's
right
very
with
funny.
That.
Okay. Anyway, and Peggy Hill would, of course, be Amy Poehler. So, I mean, totally matches up. Completely delusional. Yes. But Peggy, all of that.
Peggy, totally. Yes. So we talked last week about Rock the Boat.
Oh, my gosh.
And so they had the follow-up. I remember last week we left off our Rock the Boat coverage with the one lady.
Yeah.
She's over 40, my age.
Flash Dan.
Flashing her boobies and spent 3 days crying in her stateroom.
Yeah.
And so I'll play the audio here if I can.
I've been let down by a lot of things, but I've never, ever been let down by the New Kids. I never should have doubted that Danny would come and make things right because they care so much about their fans.
And I'm right.
I've never been let down by the New Kids. I've been let down by a lot of things.
A lot of things, but not the New Kids.
Kids. Yeah, so, yeah, it was nice. It was
and
sweet.
Then Donnie was the officiant at the wedding.
Well, finish the thing up. So she was in her stateroom crying for 3 days, and Danny heard about it. They got the GoPro footage. He came over. He knocked on her door. He gave her a big hug. He's like, I was never mad at you. I just have a family, and I just turned away. I was embarrassed, and you shouldn't feel this way. We feel so bad, and here's a sweatshirt. Like, he really went way over the top.
Yeah, it was really nice.
It was sweet. And she's like bawling about it.
He's like, oh, my God, yeah. And then the wedding girl had said to her bridesmaids, like, I want the New Kids at my wedding. And they were like, okay, sure. So the one girl, the maid of honor, just said to Donnie, like, we would love it if you could be there. If all of you guys could be there, it would be so amazing. He's like, all right, well, I'll see what I can do. I'm not going to promise anything, but I'll see what I can do.
Right.
Okay. So, cut to, they thought they were going to go to the chapel and just do the wedding and everything.
And really, when you say cut to, the producers, New Kid, whoever was behind all this, they didn't even tell the bridesmaids.
No, they didn't tell
anybody. So the bride and the bridesmaids had no clue.
None.
They're in the elevator, or rather, they're doing their dress rehearsal,
right.
Like they're staging before the actual wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And unbeknownst to the bride and all the bridesmaids, Donnie Wahlberg had gone to the groom's room and said, listen, let's go get married. I got ordained.
I'm ready to marry you guys. And then her, her new kid, cause we each have, if you're a blackhead, you have a new kid. Her new kid's actually also my new kid, the lovely and wonderful Joey McIntyre. And she had, you know, in her confessional, she's like, you know, when I was 16, I thought I'd never find anybody better for me than Joey McIntyre. And then I met Paul and he's so amazing and I just can't wait to marry him. And it was like really cool. So they're coming down in the elevator.
Well, but even that's, I know, but she was like, so Donnie, they take it a step further. She thought she was going to get married in some little, like, you know, like
the chapel. Right.
So Donnie had set up a wedding stage on like the Lido deck. And he does this little PA loudspeaker, says, hey, you know, blockheads, we're having a special event on the deck in, you know, starting in 10 minutes. Meet me on the deck and all the new kids are going to be up there. And the bride's like, no,
right during the wedding.
It's a new kids event. Oh,
I have
my
to go.
God. So she's like, I want to see what it is.
Let's go.
So let's go. So she gets in the elevator and she gets up to the top of this deck. And again, unbeknownst to her, they're like staging like a big wedding. There's now thousands of people.
Yep. The whole boat goes.
It's got like all the carpet, the like little runner thing you
Everything.
Walk on. And when the door opens, who's there?
Joey McIntyre.
Unbelievable.
In a full uniform and everything. And he goes, can I walk?
No, like officer and general, yes. like and Navy uniform.
And he says, can I walk you down the aisle? Can you not fucking stand it? He walks her childhood crush that she just had said, oh, I never thought I'd find somebody better, you know, as good as him for me. And then I met my, you know, her betrothed.
Yeah.
He walks her down the aisle and who officiates? Donnie. Donnie's like crying. He does the whole ceremony. They're all there watching. It was really awesome. And cool.
It was a pretty, we had just last week, she's like, listen, this is kind of crazy. They go so out of the way for their fans. It's unbelievable. And this was like, they dialed it up to 11.
Yeah, we thought it was good before. Now it's like, yeah, they like really go out of their way for their fans. So season finale is coming week. So it'll be the end of the series. I think it was only like six episodes. But I know the last night of the
They party until they
get to the dock. So I'll be interested to see all the shenanigans that these girls get into, especially the girls from Seattle, the super fans. I love them. We didn't get to see a lot of them because a lot of it was about the wedding this week.
Yeah.
So it'll be cool. And then,
no, but it was done really, really well.
Yeah. And then the other new show that we have been really getting into is 12 Monkeys on Sci-Fi.
I love it, man.
Oh, my gosh. It's so good. So if you guys have seen the Bruce Willis movie about the guy who comes back from the future to try and stop this deadly virus from eradicating almost all of mankind and everything and ruining the world. So they've made a TV series out of it. It's on Sci-Fi. It's so good. I mean, every week I'm like, holy shit. It like blows my mind.
It's excellent.
I mean, when you put time travel in the mix, it always can, you know, you worry it's going to turn hokey or kind of weird or do that Terminator thing. And this really has been able to avoid so much of that, but still getting the complexities of what the consequences of time travel can and could be. And I think it's just done so well, and I've really been enjoying it. I'm psyched. I think it got renewed already, so it's really cool.
It needs to.
Yeah. So watch that. And then, the last thing I want to do is just do a quick podcast standing for a new show, Open Run Show, which is a podcast hosted by Jesse Williams and his friend Stefan. You can find Stefan at Stefan My Mind. I listened to the second episode, which dealt with the aftermath of Jesse tearing his ACL during the NBA All-Star Weekend celebrity basketball game, and was very funny. I think they do talk a bunch about basketball because they're really into that, but they talk about all sorts of stuff in their life and things like that. I think it's good. They're going to do it once a week. And it was hilarious. Like I laughed out loud so much. So it's at Open Run Show. You can find them on iTunes and Stitcher and all those other places, but Open Run Show, Jesse Williams and at Stefan, My Mind. So that's cool. What else you got?
That was really it. But I definitely give a shout out to that podcast as well, Open Run Show. It was funny.
Really funny.
The two of them are comical.
Yeah. They you can tell. They're good friends and they know how to – they have a good rapport. And Jesse's very dry. He's dry humor, which I appreciate.
He kept making fun of himself.
He definitely does.
He's a doctor. He's like, well, I'm a doctor. I decided to become a doctor. Like he takes like really seriously. Like he thinks he's – not he thinks he's a doctor. Of course, he plays the doctor on TV, but it's really funny.
Yeah, and he like broke down when he hurt himself, and he's like, "Oh, there, you know, there's nothing like just tearing your ACL on national television in the mecca of basketball." And he had been talking shit the whole week before how great he was going to be. He's played in a celebrity game a bunch. crunch. Like, yeah, it was like his third.
They're
time
saying
or
that
whatever.
There's going to be like the celebrity basketball game, like pre Jesse Williams and post
Jesse Williams. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pre-injury and post-injury. Yeah. So, yeah, there's that. And what else did he say? Oh, he said that when he hurt himself, he's like, he was in a lot of pain. But then there's a point where, like, you're not in as much pain and they're taking him off. And he's like, I was, like, making jokes. He's like, oh, if only there was a real doctor here. Like, even then, he's, like, hobbling off the court, like, whatever. And then the other thing that was funny was that they didn't give any updates. So people were like, what happens when a celebrity gets hurt in the NBA celebrity basketball game? Everybody ignores it because they didn't say anything. And the guy who was doing the announcing is like, well, they didn't give me any updates. And also, he's not a sports figure. So he's like, I didn't know if you wanted people to know the state of your knee or whatever was going on. I never asked you.
And it's
not like, you know, people, I would say a basketball player or a sports figure, they know that they're, whatever is happening with them is going to be reported. The team decides what they're going to say and they say that. So, but you don't have that same expectation as an actor. What if he doesn't want people to know his ACL got torn? What if he's trying to go be a superhero next week or something, or interview or audition for a show that would be upset knowing that he didn't?
Sure. And there might be some
professional HIPAA stuff.
Yeah,
who knows?
Yeah.
So it made sense, but he said it was weird that they just didn't say anything. They're just like, yeah, Jesse got caught off the court and it was like, okay, back to the game. It was like nothing happened. So it was kind of funny. Anyway.
It's a good show.
Yeah, it's good. Well, we're going to at least try and do at least one show this coming week, right? Yeah.
We should.
And I am guesting on a show Wednesday. I'll put information up about that. Shirley and Clover are going to be on it as well with Rashani. So that'll be a cool little thing Wednesday. I don't know when it'll be up, but I'll be recording it Wednesday. And also re-recording the next episode of Ferguson Response Network this week. So
yeah, I'm working with Sean. We're trying to get Darian Hunt. So we're trying to get Darian's mom on the show as well.
Oh, cool. That'll be very interesting.
Hopefully, yeah.
To hear from her. Yeah. Well, these moms, you know how I feel about them.
Ridiculous. Well, his case is actually the federal, the Justice Department's actually not investigating.
Yeah. They're investigating all of them, aren't they?
Yes.
I did hear some rumblings that the Justice Department is going to be filing some civil rights violations against the Ferguson Police Department.
Well, they did get one of the first victories they had was that there was some law in terms of making a move. Yeah.
Yeah, the 5-minute rule or whatever. So stupid.
Ferguson's stupid.
So fun.
The Ferguson Police Department is so stupid.
The whole St. Louis, Missouri, the whole fucking thing. It's just, and that's the thing. I always want to continue to focus stuff there because it's only gotten worse. Like, I'm just being perfectly honest. And the other thing is, I think Eric Holder was just saying he wants to stop all executions, like just stop them all, the whole country. And Pennsylvania passed the new governor stopped all.
Illinois did a couple of years ago.
Well, they did that. And the Philadelphia DA is like, yeah, no, we're not stopping.
We're going to still
kill people. Like, what? Your governor just stopped it. Like, what satisfaction do you get? If they don't get killed, they're still incarcerated. You've still already proven they're guilty, right? I don't understand it. It's just like...
There was so Texas is the, you know, in terms of like killing people with the electric chair and lethal injection, they lead the all states.
Sure.
They execute more incarcerated citizens than anyone else. They have more people on death row than anyone else. But they've had a few... Like, I don't say mistakes, but more like literally they've executed people that was the wrong person. The DNA is exonerated at some point after the fact. And you'd think that, like, you know, you would just stop. You'd be like, well, one's too many. And they don't. And for me, the thing is that it just doesn't seem like is it working? Is it an actual deterrent? Like, what's your purpose of killing somebody?
Right.
It costs more money.
Right.
And I don't think people even realize that.
Yeah, because
to actually kill somebody costs a shit ton of money. All the lawsuits,
right.
I shouldn't say in a bad way, but you know, you want to make sure.
Recourse, you get it right to ensure that.
So it's crazy. Crazy, crazy, crazy.
Yeah, it's kind of nuts. So
it's a bit of a bum run on an end note, but we could end it there, I guess.
Well, yeah, I guess we can end it there.
That's the king of segues.
Good night, everybody.
High five.